Hello, and welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Crystal. We're librarians at Nashville Public Library.
This podcast is where you can find reviews and recommendations of the best books, movies, and music available for checkout from the Popular Materials Department of the Nashville Public Library.
You can also learn about library programs such as concerts, film screenings, book clubs, author talks, and book signings.
Hey, Pumpkinhead. It's October. We light the bag of dog poo on your porch with our discussion of our favorite classic horror films. I would stretch this metaphor even further by saying Amanda and I's discussion of Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel is like a razor blade in an apple, but that's just an urban legend. Guard yourself for truth.
I can't believe you watched that.
Hello, this is Jeremy. October has 31 days, and a couple of years ago, I tried to watch 31 horror movies in 31 days, but I gave up after 12 because I can't commit to things. But what I can commit to is the film Monster Squad, which will be presented at the main library October 23rd at 2 p.m. by local horror hound Dr. Gangrene. So if you're not familiar with the film Monster Squad, it's basically Goonies with the monsters. There's a cool kid, there's the nerdy hero kid, there's the fat kid who in Goonies is called Chunk, but in Monster Squad is called Fat Kid. And they team up with scary German guy to fight Dracula, Frankenstein, the creature from the Black Lagoon, and I think the mummy, too. And the Wolfman, has nards, so remember that if you ever encounter a Wolfman in the future. So all this reminiscing about Monster Squad for myself has made me think about what horror movies are close to our hearts. Bill, is there one that's close to your heart?
Well, yes. I want to talk a little bit about my history with this particular movie, and the movie I want to talk about is Rosemary's Baby. Now, when this film was first released, it was in 1968, and I was way too young to see that movie. But yet, I still remember going up to the Springfield Cinema, and I think it went to see The Love Bug of all movies. And here is this trailer, and it's not a trailer. It's just a small, it's not even a clip from the movie. It's a baby carriage on this sort of mountainous terrain. The baby's crying. The wind's blowing. There's smog. And then all it says was, pray for Rosemary's baby. Well, you know, after my mother got me out from under my seat so I could watch The Love Bug, I mean, just the trailer made a huge impression on me. Now, cut to several years later, I'm talking 1982 when the VCR age came in, because this was a movie that just wasn't shown on television. It was hard to find. It was hard to see movies in those days. And our parents bought the first VCR. I was home from college and went to the local Curtis Mathis video store, and there was Rosemary's Baby on video. I got up at like 8 o'clock in the morning, and my father was sitting there reading the paper. And I said, is it okay if I watch a movie? And he said, yes. So I stuck in Rosemary's Baby. Well, my father's reading the paper, but as the movies progressed, his eye would continuously go to the movie. About this time, my mother got up, and she did her thing. We were already halfway through the movie, and she just stopped and just started looking at this movie for, I guess, 20 minutes. And they were both just entranced by this. And then my mother finally said, is this the one where she has the devil's baby? And I said, yes. And then she went on about her married business. It was just kind of a surreal. You're looking at Rosemary's Baby, which is what this movie does. It has this wonderful surrealness to it. It mixes the mundane with the surrealisticness of what's going on. It's just hypnotic, and it's a totally weird story. And that was just my reaction to the movie. I've since seen it several other times on DVD with widescreen. And I've really grown to love the movie. It's surreal sense of humor, or should I say macabre sense of humor. For an example of that, after Rosemary's become pregnant, a friend of her comes up and says, well, congratulations, Papa, to which a guy replies, thanks, there was nothing to it. and it just has all these wonderful double entendres in it. Also, the casting of it, which struck me, there was Hope Summers, and she plays Mrs. Gilmore in the movie, but she's better known as Clara Edwards on the old Andy Griffin Show. And there she is playing a witch in part of the coven in Rosemary's Baby. So it's always a fascinating movie, and it's hypnotic. It's not that it's scary, but it really gets under your skin. It's more, its ambiguity is just absolutely brilliant, because you really don't know if she's imagining this or is it real. It just mixes, the mundane with the surreal, and several brilliant performances, and especially Ruth Gordon. It's also got all these great people who work behind the scenes of it. Sam Osteen was the film editor, legendary film editor, and William Fraker, the director of photography. So it's one that holds up very well today, better than it did in 1968.
You told me a great story about this movie one time. You said that at the library, a pregnant lady came up to you and asked for any movie recommendations. You said Rosemary's Baby. You said she just looked at you and just kind of gave you a scowl and walked away.
It's that movie that has that aura about it. People know that movie.
Yeah.
So Monster Squad got me thinking, right, about classic horror films. And like a lot of old classic horror films, like I don't think people really watch them anymore. I think that we know the monsters and we know the images and we know Bela Lugosi as Dracula and we know that picture, but I'm not really sure how many people actually watched the original Dracula with Bela Lugosi. But we have a version here at the library with this new score written by Philip Glass and performed by the Kronos Quartet. So if you're not someone that, you know, would normally get an old movie, I think that score could be a hook, you know, for you to see that movie and see what it was all about. And then if you start there and you watch that original Dracula, you can watch other versions of the Dracula story. And the fun of watching Dracula movies is always going to be who plays Renfield, like Dracula's evil, crazy, insane minion. So it's like which character actor is going to play Renfield and how crazy are they going to be? So that's a good starting point to explore from. And since I work in the fiction department, I got to throw in some books. If you want some good horror, you should read H.P. Lovecraft. You know, he's the beginning of the crazy, lunatic, weird horror. You should start there.
Anybody want to share their favorite scariest moments where you probably jump the highest and scream the loudest?
We might have this in the system, but there was an adaptation of It, the Stephen King book, that was on TV, which I don't know if it holds up now or not, but it scared me to death when I was a kid, for years and years. And at this clown, played by Tim Curry, kills children. There was a scene where the clown's face is in a sewer grate, and he's like, come down here, I'll kill you, or whatever. And for years, if I was walking somewhere at night by myself, or even with people, I would look at that sewer grate and I would go away from the sewer grate. I could not.
You're going to have to walk me to my car now.
I'm sorry. It's still daylight now. Killers don't come out at night. But I couldn't. I was in fifth grade, I think, when it came out. It seems like months that I couldn't sleep from that movie because it all went back to, I had this painting of a clown that my mother had bought at some home store or something to decorate my room with things that had nothing to do with things that I was interested in. And it was of a clown with his hand up. And he had a tiny little top hat on, and I saw it in the moonlight at night with my eyes open, and the picture, the clown was changing. Its face would, like, sort of, in the dark of the blue moonlight, its image changed shapes into a snarling beast. And so this, just like the clown in the movie, and that stuck with me for a long time. So much so that I was at a Goodwill one time, and I found the exact same clown painting and bought it and now have it face down in my basement to sort of...
Face down.
Yeah, exactly, face down.
My personal favorite is, I wasn't expecting it, was once again of the video era. It never was released at theater. It was of an unknown origin. And it's with Peter Weller.
I've seen that. We have that here.
Yes, and I just, you know, it's essentially Peter Weller doing once again something mundane, going to the bathroom. And then he opens his toilet seat, and there's a rat, a very vicious rat in the toilet, and growls at him. I remember when I saw this, I was watching it late at night, I literally jumped. It was just like, And I wasn't expecting that because I really didn't know what the movie was about. Yeah. And after that, it just created this tension through it. And it's, I like to plug that because that's a little unknown horror film. Yeah.
Can't believe you read that.
Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall is the fictional biography of Thomas Cromwell. This Cromwell was the Rahm Emanuel or Karl Rove for Henry VIII. And this Henry was the guy that divorced or murdered six of his wives and separated England from the Roman Catholic Church just so he could divorce one of said wives. So Thomas Cromwell was his fixer. The only British monarch to be the subject of more literature was probably Arthur. And I think Mantel was really brave to revisit this material. And when Wolf Hall was published last year, it got really good reviews and ended up on the bestseller list. And this is one of the few books that Amanda and I both wanted to read because we really don't like the same things.
That's true.
Right? So we both are like, well, let's just, you know, let's read it together and then we'll talk about it on the podcast. So, Amanda, what did you think?
Going into it, I did not realize that it was going to be so much about Cromwell. I thought it was... Everything I'd read about it was, oh, it's this Henry VIII story, and yay, we like Henry VIII. And so I was really kind of interested because I didn't know that much about Cromwell. I mean, I knew who he was, and I kind of knew what, you know, his gig was with Henry, but I didn't realize how he came into power. I don't know about you, but when I was reading the book, it seemed to work better for me in big chunks. Like when I could sit down and read for half an hour or an hour, whatever. It seemed to work a little better when, you know, I was trying to grab five pages here and five pages there. You kind of got lost in it, at least I did, because the way that that Mantel structures it, I would lose who the speaker was and I would lose what they were talking about, and so you'd have to go back. And so once I kind of got used to her writing style, it started to work, but it's kind of a slow process to read it for me.
I think that you're right. I mean, it's really long, and there were a lot of people.
There were a ton of people.
Yes, and it's a serious literary book. It's not like beach read.
No.
You know?
You have to focus.
And you do have to focus. It is very funny, though. Like, the Cromwell character, who's, like, really the focus of the book, he's really funny and really witty.
He always has something to say.
And he always has something to say, but I think it was a little bit long. I think, too, with so many characters and so much drama happening, it was really just focused on Cromwell when you could have had some serious drama, which has been the subject of so many other books and mm-hmm. plays and movies. But it really, you know, it didn't go there.
Do you think that's the Englishness of it? Because that's kind of how I took it, was that the book itself focused on Cromwell and his thoughts and his what he was saying to people as opposed to the actual events. Like, it was more about his brain and what was in his head, as opposed to, you know, because all the things, like all the drama with Henry, and all the stuff, and it was all in the background, like it was all behind closed doors, like you heard about it after the fact. So, because it was all about, and then it was like what somebody thought of, like what Norfolk thought about it, or Suffolk thought about it, or, you know, what his, I don't know what his seconds were called, Rafe and Richard and Gregory. Yeah. So, I mean, it was like what all these people thought about stuff and what was going. It was all the gossip. It wasn't the actual event. So I don't know if that was just the Englishness of it or if she meant to do that, but I personally could have had a little bit more action.
I think that she was trying to do some revisionist history, right?
Maybe so,
because
yeah.
There's this idea that Cromwell was a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, too, there's the idea that we're familiar with the story. Like, mm-hmm. we know the story already. Like, it's on TV right now. Like, Tudors is on TV yeah. right now, right?
Yeah.
So we know the story of the parts about Henry and his wives. So this is a different perspective. And then, too, in other sources, like, Cromwell was always bad. You know, he was a bad dude.
Mm-hmm.
He was a mean guy, you know?
Which is funny you say that, because this book actually made me like him more.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've watched him on TV at the Tudors, and I was like, oh, he's just, you know, a side. But I liked him in the book. I mean, I really did.
Well, I think the whole idea, she's trying to rehabilitate him,
mm-hmm.
you know,
his character.
In English literature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So that being said, I mean, I kind of agreed with you as, like, you know, if I kind of give it like a B minus or a
yeah.
C plus. It's a little long. And what I think is... I think, you know, she is a British author, right?
Yeah, she's British, right?
So I think in the UK, they were just really excited that someone had written a new
mm-hmm.
good book about Henry VIII and his
yeah.
court. They were like, oh, wow, because they thought that was dead, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, or you, you know.
Well, I don't know if this was a response to the Tudors TV show, because that is so over-the-top sensationalized. I mean, people are, you know, being killed and hung, and you're witnessing all of this. And so I don't know if this was kind of her response to that, pulling back and saying, okay, it wasn't all that. You know, this is really kind of another angle to look at it. I don't know, because, I mean, I kind of liked that because it was so different from the extreme television show, but then on the other hand, it maybe took it too far to Bland Town, I guess. Are we going to ponder the ending? I mean, is that too spoilery?
I think people know the story.
You're not going to be surprised.
Yeah. But she is supposed to be writing another book, right?
I hadn't heard.
So she's supposed to write another book.
Well, good.
Because you go to say where it stops?
Well, it ends. It ends. Anne's still living. He's still living. Like, nothing's... So we didn't even get through two of Henry's six wives. I mean, we haven't... You know, Elizabeth has been born. I'm trying to think. Oh, Thomas More dies right at the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally...
Good God, no.
Yeah. Sorry, did we wreck that for you? Because he dies. And then, of course, this is the Thomas More that wrote Utopia and, you know, was also an advisor to Henry VIII prior to Cromwell's term. But that's just... And it just kind of stops. And it's not really... Like, there's no really resolution and...
Well, I think the story arc, I think, is Cromwell going from a nobody to a somebody,
yeah,
and then also Wolsey being in power,
mm-hmm,
and then Wolsey, you know, not being in power, and then Cromwell taking
rising
his spot.
Yeah.
You know, so there's, like, political drama and political intrigue. And then also the arc of More being really powerful to being executed.
Mm-hmm, forgotten, yeah. And I do think that if she's writing a second book, it sets up that, because, like, the last line is they're going to go see the Seymours, who live at Wolf Hall, hence the title of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which
exactly.
I thought that was kind of weird to set up the title of the book when the Seymours are a very small part, barely even mentioned. But if she's going further, then maybe the title's going to be We Finally Get There.
It's a pregnant title, though.
Exactly.
Because it's like Wolf Hall, and like, mm-hmm, they're outside of the picture. You know, like, Jane Seymour's always just mentioned, but,
yeah,
you know,
she's floating
has some
on
dialogue.
The edges of.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't realize that his son, Cromwell's son, Gregory, marries Jane's sister. So they all get familiarized.
Yeah, that happens with royal people.
Yeah, they all marry each other. And,
you know what? If the second one does come out, I want to read it. I do.
I want to start it. I'm not sure I'm going to give 532 pages to her, but...
Well, I think she's a good writer, and I do like the Cromwell character. I mean, he's interesting.
Yeah.
He says it many times that he doesn't know who he is, because,
mm-hmm,
there's the idea that even within the book itself, he's perceived as, like, an enforcer, or as a guy that, like, you will do what I want you to do, whether you want to or not, you know, either because I'm strong or I'm a snake, right? You're going to do what I want you to do.
Well, they paint that portrait of him, and everybody says he looks like a murderer, and he doesn't see it until, mm-hmm, like, really late in the book. He says, oh, okay.
Well, the portrait, too, is painted by, like, Hans Holbein is a really famous painter, and,
mm-hmm,
like, you know, you can Google that and see the painting. It does not look like the Cromwell that she portrays.
Not
it looks
at all.
Like someone who's a killer. You know, the look in his eyes is like, he looks like he's looking at someone who he wants to kill,
mm-hmm,
like who's out of frame.
Yeah. What did you think of just her writing style and just the verb tense, writing in first-person present tense?
It was okay. I mean, the one thing that I noticed is her vocabulary was really big on adjectives but not big on verbs.
Yeah, okay.
For me, that's a criticism, right? Like, it's easy to have lots of adjectives, but, you know, if you have good verbs, then you're probably better.
Mm-hmm. It was just weird. It took me a minute to get into the present tense of people that have been dead for 500 years.
Well, that's hard whenever...
I mean, that...
It would jump forward chronologically,
mm-hmm,
and there were so many characters and so many people with the same name.
Oh, Thomas.
So that was difficult. And you know what even made it harder for me was I started listening to it on audio CD, and it was great. The guy that was the reader, he got the Welsh accents wrong at the beginning. But after
that,
it was wonderful, right? After that, it was so good. I switched and started reading it on an e-reader, and, like, the audio was just richer because the actor,
mm-hmm,
had so many voices for all those characters. And then reading on, like, a plain book, I mean,
mm-hmm,
it lost something. So if you have time to listen to it, I mean, I would
help.
Listen to it.
Yeah, because I just read the book, and it got a little dry in places.
So I think I'm wondering, like, so who would you recommend this book for? You know, if you're interested in the period, if,
mm-hmm,
you've read everything
definitely
about Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII, and you want some more, I think you probably would like it. You'd probably
be
into
it. Rate Mantell is quite as high. I've read some Philippa Gregory. She's the other big writer of this time period, and I liked hers better, but that just might be because of the stories that she was telling, as opposed to the, she wasn't talking about Cromwell and all that. But I mean, I thought this would put this in that same category.
Yeah. Well, why do you think it won this big prize? Because the Men Book Prize is like one of the.
I just think it's kind of what you said, that nobody had really tackled this subject before, and everybody in the UK was like, "Yay, go Cromwell!" And so.
Yeah, I mean, I think that too. I think that so many bad books are written that someone wrote a book that was like above average, and then it wins a prize.
Yeah,
because so many bad books are written. I think too that the Man Booker, like, it usually goes to people who are like. Nowadays, because we're all, like, multicultural, like, it usually goes to people who are from British colonies, not someone who's actually from the UK or about UK history or a Canadian or an Australian, you know? But then, like, they finally sort of, like, well, here's someone who's writing revisionist history that's actually about UK history, about our most famous king. So I felt like that kind of maybe tipped the tables because the book was, you know, it had flaws.
Yeah. I had a hard time getting the characters from the TV show out of my head to try to... Because they were... A lot of these were different than... Like, the way she portrayed them were different than the TV show portrayed them. They're all hunkier and cuter. I mean, even Henry VIII is, you know, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, who, he's a pretty handsome guy and not heavy like Henry at all. So it's kind of interesting to see how, and they've kind of fixed him into the character a little more as the show's progressed. But, so that, yeah, that was my problem.
I mean, I think that in Wolf Hall, Henry's kind of a pushover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like he's... thinks he's in control, but really, like, Anne and Cromwell, like, just make him feel like he's in control when really he's not.
And what did Norfolk and Suffolk, and they were all... The Suffolk married his sister, so... Is that our best thought?
Do we need to close? How can we... I think, is that okay?
Close it.
I think, we could close like the book closes and just stop.
Yeah, so I think we're going to close like the book closes, and we're just kind of going to stop.
We're going to go to Wolf Hall and have a nice day.
But maybe we'll do this again with different books. So if any,
I think we should. So feel free to request not 500 page books.
Yeah, leave it in the. You can go and leave comments, you know, on the podcast page of books you might want us to talk about.
We'll all have to read it.
Yeah. Oh, I will. Since I've thrown that out there, I will read. Yeah. I will read any book that you want me to read. At least skim it.
You've been listening to Nashville Public Library's Pop-Matic podcast. For more information, please visit www.library.nashville.org.
That's on the interwebs.